From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Henry Kissinger, the secretive diplomat and the savvy celebrity. We'll talk with Walter Isaacson, the author of a new biography of Kissinger. Isaacson describes Kissinger as brilliant but conspiratorial, charming but deceitful. Isaacson will tell us about some of the secrets Kissinger kept as a diplomat, and we'll find out what he's up to now as a foreign affairs expert for hire by large corporations with business interests overseas. And Maureen Corrigan reviews the book Young Men and Fire by Norman MacLean. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Governor Bill Clinton spoke at Notre Dame University today and used the occasion to talk about religious tolerance, quoting from Scripture and two bishops' pastoral letters. NPR's Ira Glass reports.
The Southern Baptist candidate came before a Catholic audience and quoted what a Catholic presidential candidate, John F. Kennedy, said to Baptists in 1960.
John Kennedy reminded the Baptist ministers in Houston in 1960, when intolerance is turned loose, and I quote, "Today I may be the victim, but tomorrow it may be you. Until the whole fabric of our harmonious society is ripped."
Though he never referred specifically to the recent Republican convention, Clinton said that he was appalled to hear the voices of intolerance raised in recent weeks, voices, he said, that even called for a religious war. At this Catholic school, Clinton was heckled throughout the early part of his speech by students who called out pro-life bill and what about the babies. I'm Ira Glass in South Bend, Indiana.
A federal employees group said today that it will sue if the president follows through with a plan to cut their pay. The Senior Executives Association represents most of the federal government's most highly paid employees, those earning more than $90,000 a year. President Bush has proposed that federal employees making more than $75,000 a year take a 5% pay cut. The association said that amounts to a breach of faith with senior federal employees. Mideast peace talks are now in recess, but reports from Israel indicate Israel and Syria are exchanging proposals that could lead to a settlement. Israel would give up part of the Golan Heights, according to these reports, in exchange for peace. Barry Schweid has more on the situation.
From the outset, more than 6 months ago, Bush administration officials have been hopeful that once Israelis and Arabs sit down at the bargaining table, the likelihood of them groping their way toward a settlement would be much greater. Through the first few rounds, the two sides fenced over procedure. For a couple more, they talked about the issues, but without real give and take. But now, with the election of a new government in Israel, the negotiations are getting serious. The Rabin government provided the opening by notifying the Syrians at the table 2 weeks ago that UN resolutions calling for Israeli withdrawal apply to the Golan Heights. This, in turn, prompted the Syrians to talk about an end to the long conflict between the two countries. There is still a long way to go to a settlement. Syria wants all the territory back, for instance, and Israel has used the Golan Heights as a security buffer. But for the first time, the two sides are talking about an agreement directly, across the table from each other. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained less than a point to finish the day at 3,305. This is NPR News. A hurricane with the destructive power of Hurricane Andrew and possibly more is poised to strike the Hawaiian Islands in about 4 hours. Hurricane Iniki is carrying sustained winds of about 145 miles per hour with gusts as high as 175. The National Weather Service has issued hurricane warnings for the islands of Kauai, Niihau, and Oahu. Navy ships at Pearl Harbor were sent to sea early today, and Navy planes are being flown to Moffett Field in California. The mayor of Honolulu has ordered the evacuation of coastal areas on the west side of Oahu. Six students were shot in an Amarillo, Texas high school today after an argument between two students turned violent. Carrie King reports from Amarillo.
What started out as a high school pep rally turned into a shooting gallery in Amarillo, Texas this morning. According to officials, a 17-year-old opened fire on fellow students at Peladura High School after an altercation during the pep rally. Six students were shot and taken to a local hospital. The most serious injury is a gunshot wound to the chest. One student was trampled during the chaos that followed the shooting as students tried to leave the building. Amarillo police have two student suspects in custody. The 17-year-old is considered an adult and is being held in the Potter County Jail. A 15-year-old is also in custody for allegedly trying to hide the weapon used in the shooting. For National Public Radio, I'm Carrie King in Amarillo.
Florida Governor Lawton Chiles said today that it may not be possible to get Congress to fund the rebuilding of Homestead Air Force Base. The base was virtually demolished by Hurricane Andrew, but President Bush promised that it would be rebuilt. The base accounts for more than 25% of the area's economy. People in the area had been hoping for $480 million to restore the base, but a Senate committee rejected the request yesterday. Governor Chiles suggested that a less expensive commercial airport might be built in its place. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There's a new biography of Henry Kissinger that's been called the book to end all books on Kissinger. My guest is the author, Walter Isaacson. The Kissinger that emerges in this book is brilliant, but conspiratorial. Kissinger was President Nixon's national security advisor and President Ford's Secretary of State. He won a Nobel Peace Prize for his negotiations to end the war in Vietnam. He negotiated the opening of relations with China. The expression shuttle diplomacy was created to describe his style. Kissinger became a superstar diplomat. He was on the cover of more than 20 issues of Time magazine. And he made the celebrity party scene, often with a beautiful actress on his arm. Isaacson's book is not an authorized biography, but Kissinger did grant him a couple dozen interviews.
He is a person who deeply, deeply cares about his place in history, his reputation, and explaining himself. I think one thing he didn't like about the book is that when I started researching his life, his childhood, everything else, you sense a great mixture of ego and insecurity in him. And it's a combustible mixture that leads to somebody really caring deeply about how people portray him or how mm-hmm. people think of him.
Did your mind change a lot about Kissinger during the course of writing the book?
Well, I tried not to make up my mind before I started what I thought of him. As I did the research, I found that I was a little bit more impressed with some of the brilliance of his foreign policy maneuvers and the structures of foreign policy he created, the detente with the Soviet Union being balanced against an opening to China, and that all being balanced against the shuttle diplomacy in the Middle East and a somewhat messy withdrawal from Vietnam. But how he saw all of those linkages impressed me. On the other hand, the more I learned about his method of operation, his secretiveness, his willingness to deceive the State Department, the way he would tell one side one thing and then shade it a different way when he talked to the other side, I felt that that was not only not very impressive, but it was ultimately destructive, because foreign policy in a democracy has to have some openness and some honesty, because in the long run, it's got to be based on the support of the people, the support of Congress, the support of the bureaucracy, the support of the whole State Department. And when you don't lay that groundwork by openly describing what you're doing, it comes back to haunt you.
Well, let's talk about his secrecy. You describe Kissinger and Nixon as co-conspirators. Now, Kissinger was Nixon's national security advisor and Secretary of State. In what way did you see them as co-conspirators?
They liked to sit in that hideaway office Nixon had in the executive office building right across from the White House. They would sit there for hours figuring out surprise ploys they could pull off and gambits, such as the secret opening to China where Kissinger took that trip without even telling the State Department or anybody else. It was a perfect secret that he was going to go to China and then announce that Nixon was going to make a grand trip to China. That was done sitting around with Nixon privately, either in the executive office building or in the Lincoln sitting room in the upstairs of the White House late at night, where they would plot these things. And they were so afraid of leaks such as leaks about the secret bombing of Cambodia that was done without the cooperation of the top levels of the Defense Department or the State Department. They were so afraid of leaks that they began wiretapping their aides. And after a while, you had a program of national security wiretapped where even Kissinger's closest advisors and the closest advisors of the Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense and a lot of reporters in Washington all had wiretaps on their home phones to make sure that nobody was spilling secrets. And that became very destructive because Nixon and Kissinger, I think, relished the wiretap transcripts and the wiretap reports a little bit too much and were just a little bit too eager to tap their aides. It was an illegal program, and it really undermined trust in government.
Well, you say that Kissinger himself was indirectly the subject of a wiretap.
That's right. Nixon was distrustful, too, and he thought Kissinger, correctly, he thought that Kissinger was doing a lot of the leaking. So some of the wiretaps were put on reporters that Kissinger was known to talk to. And Nixon, of course, secretly taped his conversations in the White House. Kissinger, somewhat secretly, a few people knew about it, taped his own phone conversations, including his private phone conversations with Nixon, and had transcripts made, and he would show them to a few close aides.
Did Nixon know?
I think Nixon knew that Kissinger had a taping system on the phone. I'm pretty sure, having read some of these transcripts, that Nixon didn't realize that the taping was on all the time and that even the most private conversations were being taped. Likewise, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, all of these people had secret taping systems. And Melvin Laird, who was the defense secretary, was getting the wiretaps from the National Security Agency, which is a super-secret agency that listens in on long-distance phone conversation and satellite transmissions. So everybody was sort of tapping one another, doing things behind one another's back. And an important point to bear in mind, I think, is that this atmosphere, this sort of conspiratorial atmosphere, is what really laid the groundwork for Watergate.
Did you get access to any of the tapes of the phone calls?
Yes. Those tapes are very secret. They're very sealed. But different people have access to them. In other words, certain aides or certain of the principals, certain of the people who were doing it, would keep their tapes or their transcripts, especially of amazing phone calls. And so people, as I went around and did my reporting over the past 6 years, people would show me some of the telephone conversations that were had or some of the secret memos that were taken at the meetings. And, of course, Haldeman took notes at every meeting that he had with Nixon and Kissinger, and those were available, some of them in the National Archives in Washington and some of them through Haldeman and Ehrlichman. So if you as you wander around for 6 years talking to people, they're kind of eager to show you the things and mementos they've saved. Now, for example, during the Yom Kippur War in October 73, Watergate was at its peak. Nixon was about to fire the Watergate special prosecutor, Archibald Cox. He was totally out of the loop when at the end of the October 73 war, because he was so preoccupied with Watergate. He was drinking somewhat. He was going to bed early. So the phone conversations of Haig, of Kissinger, and of some of the other players reveal them bringing the country to a nuclear alert and not telling the president about it. And all of that, to me, was absolutely fascinating.
You know, you describe Kissinger and Nixon as oddly matched and oddly repelled by one another. In the oddly repelled by one another category, something I think is actually pretty amusing, is you describe how when Nixon would get particularly rambling on a conversation with Kissinger, Kissinger would invite an aide to listen in while Kissinger, like, rolled his eyes.
Kissinger had a dead key, what was called a dead key, on his phones, which meant that if he was on the phone and he wanted an aide to listen in, they could pick up another extension and not be heard. And the most amazing case of this is the very famous Final Days scene where Nixon, the night before he's going to resign, calls Kissinger over to the White House, and they pray together, and Nixon starts crying and talking about his place in history. And afterwards, Kissinger, drenched in sweat, walks back to his office in the West Wing of the White House, and there's Lawrence Eagleburger and Brent Scowcroft, two of his top aides, both of whom are now in the Bush administration. And as they're sitting there and Kissinger's recounting this amazing dark scene, the phone, the private phone, rings from Nixon's study, the Lincoln bedroom study, and Kissinger picks up the phone. Nixon starts to ramble. And he signaled, and Kissinger signals to Lawrence Eagleburger to pick up the dead key, and they listen in on that conversation.
Why do you think that, actually, I kind of dropped the ball here. You were just before this mentioning how Kissinger kind of brought us to a nuclear red alert during the Yom Kippur War without informing the president.
At the very end of the October 73 Yom Kippur War, the Israelis and the Egyptians were both violating a ceasefire that had been put in place. So the Soviets were threatening to send in troops to enforce the ceasefire. And Nixon could not be roused from bed, according to Al Haig, who was then the chief of staff for the president. He had gone to bed, probably, according to the conversations, had a couple of drinks, and Haig said, "We can't wake up the president." So in a meeting that Kissinger chaired in the White House with the defense secretary, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Al Haig, and Kissinger, and a couple of other players, they decide to bring the country to a nuclear alert as a way of scaring the Soviets into backing down from sending in troops. It may have been a proper move, but the amazing thing is Nixon didn't find out about it really until the next day.
Do you know what his reaction was when he found out?
At least according to the meeting notes, he didn't have much of a reaction, and I think he was so preoccupied with his own Watergate problems that he just listened to the briefing. Another thing on that October 73 war, Kissinger is in Moscow trying to negotiate the ceasefire right as the war is about to end. And he calls up Al Haig and says, and is quite upset because the president fired off some cable. The president had not been paying much attention to these negotiations, but all of a sudden fires off a cable that says Kissinger has full authority to do whatever he wants. Now, usually Kissinger would like such a cable, but at that time he was trying to stall because he wanted the Israelis to be able to push their offensive just a little bit further, and he was telling the Russians he couldn't do anything until he checked back with the president. So Kissinger is furious at this cable that wasn't supposed to come from the president, giving him full authority to make a decision on the spot. So he calls up Al Haig at the White House, and he says, "What are you doing? Why are you letting the president send off these cables?" And it's a Saturday night, and Al Haig says, "I'm too busy. I can't talk to you." And Kissinger says, "What could be happening that's so important on a Saturday night in Washington?" And Haig pauses for a moment, and he says, "Well, it's what's called the Saturday Night Massacre, and Nixon has just fired Archibald Cox, and the Attorney General Elliot Richardson has just resigned." And there's another pause, and Kissinger says, "I understand. I guess you're busy."
Well, you know, it must be pretty alarming when you're writing a book like this and you find out how dysfunctional our government can really be.
Well, they were dysfunctional, but and also, I must say, because you have to give credit where credit is due, there were a lot of brilliant initiatives, too. It was that dark conspiratorial side of Kissinger and Nixon that led them, I think, to understand how the Soviets would react to an opening to China, how to balance off the Chinese desire for a better relationship with the United States with the Soviet desire for an arms control treaty, and to use that balance, going behind the backs of one of the Soviets and going behind the backs of the Chinese, so that they would be pitted against each other and be less likely to support the Vietnamese communists and lead to a quicker resolution of the Vietnam War. So you have to have a sort of conspiratorial mindset to conduct that type of foreign policy. And to be fair, there are some advantages or at least some benefits that came from that foreign policy, as well as some frightening scenes.
I'll tell you what, let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more about your biography of Henry Kissinger. My guest is Walter Isaacson. This is Fresh Air. Walter Isaacson is my guest, and we're discussing his new biography of Henry Kissinger. Why do you think that Kissinger was so secretive? Why did he develop such a furtive approach to diplomacy?
Well, I start off the book with Kissinger being a young Orthodox Jewish boy in a suburb of Nuremberg, Germany, called Furth. And the Nazis were just coming to power, and Jewish kids were always at a risk of getting beaten up. And he became a great soccer fan, Kissinger did, as a young boy, as a 6 or 7 or 8 year old. And they passed what was called the Nuremberg Laws, which prevented Jews from any public gatherings, including soccer games. So Kissinger and his brother and a few other friends, but mainly Henry Kissinger, would sneak into the soccer games using an assumed name or pretending to be a boy from a different school or that sort of thing. And every now and then he would get caught and would get beaten up. And it was growing up with this beleaguered childhood, but also knowing that he was smarter and more clever and more brilliant than the people around him, that I think made him feel very vulnerable, very insecure, but also very arrogant and egotistical. And that mixture led him, I think, on his as part of his diplomatic philosophy, to believe in a quest for order, to believe that power rather than moral righteousness determined the way the world worked. And it also led him to try to seek approval from powerful people, and also led him to be, I think, somewhat conspiratorial as he tried to gain support from people on various sides of an issue.
That's a psychological analysis and of his secrecy. You have a political analysis as well.
First of all, Kissinger did not have an appreciation for the openness of the American democratic system. He was more of a realist who liked conducting diplomacy in secret. He felt that if you consulted with Congress and the whole State Department, say, about the opening to China, it would never take place. And to be fair to him, if there had been a great national debate about the opening to China, and if Congress had known about it and it had leaked out, it would have been much harder to have the opening to China. Likewise, he wanted to keep control and get the credit, as did Nixon, rather than allowing the State Department to have credit for certain things. They wanted the credit and the surprise of the opening to China. Also, on the Vietnam peace agreements, the State Department was conducting negotiations, but Kissinger wanted to have secret negotiations in Paris that he could control, that he could get credit for, that he and Nixon could be the ones that would be in charge of. And so he opened up the secret Paris peace negotiations with Le Docteau in Paris.
I think perhaps Kissinger's most famous secret policy was the secret bombing of Cambodia during the Vietnam War. You say that the secret bombing of Cambodia wasn't meant to be as secretive as it became, but the secrecy gradually became more important than the bombing itself. What do you mean by that?
That's very important to understand how destructive the secretiveness can be. What happened was there were communist sanctuaries of Vietnamese communists that were based right over the border in Cambodia. And there had been a few cross-border raids where we tried to wipe them out. But those sanctuaries kept growing, and it was hard to conduct the Vietnam War with those sanctuaries there in Cambodia. So secretly, without consulting Congress or even without consulting the State Department or even the Secretary of the Air Force, Nixon and Kissinger decided to launch one major bombing strike against the communist sanctuaries in Cambodia. They hoped to knock out the headquarters of the Vietnamese communists that were based there. And they felt that if they did it publicly, then there would be great outcry, there would be more riots in the streets, Congress would cut off funds, so they decided to do it secretly. Well, the bombing happened, and it did not knock out the headquarters. It was not a very successful bombing, but they were able to keep it secret. There was no outcry. So they decide to bomb again, and the single bombing that was supposed to take place becomes a series of bombings over an entire year. And they became more and more afraid that the secret would leak out. And that's why when the first leak appeared, there was a story in the New York Times that gave an indication that there may be bombing in Cambodia. That's when the wiretapping program started. That's when they started tapping the phones of various people, and eventually it's when they formed a plumber's unit to try to stop the leaks. And the wiretapping and the plumber's unit and eventually Watergate was far more destructive to the United States than that bombing ever was, that whole year of secret bombing ever was to the communists based in Cambodia.
Well, this actually gets to one of your greatest criticisms of Kissinger, which is that he created a foreign policy without morality.
Kissinger was a realist, in European terms, a practitioner of realpolitik, like the people he studied in college, Metternich and Bismarck. American foreign policy since Woodrow Wilson, and even before then, you can go all the way back to Thomas Jefferson, is usually based on certain values. Jefferson said that he would swear on the altar of God eternal opposition to tyranny over the minds of men, and that should be the basis of our foreign policy. Wilson talked about democracy as being the basis of our foreign policy. Americans very rarely like to get involved in the world unless they believe they're doing the right thing. Unlike other countries who can engage in balance of power diplomacy, Americans like to believe that they're fighting in order to protect their ideals, not protecting some balance of power or stable world order. And I think eventually Kissinger publicly argued that morality should not play a major role in foreign policy, that that was too romantic and too sentimental. We had to conduct an unsentimental foreign policy based on national interest, not based on some misguided notions of human rights or values or democracy. I think that that was an important foreign policy to pursue for a while after the Vietnam period, because we had to reestablish our role in the world after the debacle of Vietnam. But I do not think over the long run in America, in a democracy, in an open democracy where people have some say in foreign policy, you can conduct a foreign policy in which you treat morality and values and human rights as minor considerations rather than the fundamental basis for our foreign policy. We can now look back. The Cold War is over. And what won the Cold War for the United States was not brilliant balances of power or that we were able to match Soviet power missile for missile. What won the Cold War in 1988, 1990, 1991 was that the rest of the world began to accept the American values. And it was the American values and the strength of its system that ended up being the thing that caused the rollback of and the dissolution of the Soviet Empire. Not our balances of powers, but the respect people had around the world for our ideals of democracy and human rights.
Kissinger really wanted to be in the Reagan administration. Reagan didn't want Kissinger to be in the administration. Why not?
Kissinger faced a dilemma in American politics. He was reviled by both people on the left, the doves on the left, who saw him as a strange Lovian warmonger. But he also was resented and in many ways hated by people on the right. The conservative movement in America never accepted Henry Kissinger, partly because he was part of the Eastern establishment, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, the Rockefeller wing of the Republican Party. So he never got along well with the right wing of the Republican Party. When Ronald Reagan made his challenge to Gerry Ford for the Republican nomination in 1976, he lost that race and then later, 4 years later, went on to be president. But when Reagan challenged Gerry Ford for the nomination in 76, he made Kissinger the issue. Reagan ran against detente. He ran against the fact that Kissinger was conducting an amoral foreign policy, one that was not willing to stand up against the immorality of the Soviet Union, one that was too soft and was more interested in arms control agreements than it was in taking on the Soviet Union. So Ronald Reagan made Kissinger the issue, just as Jimmy Carter did, by the way, from the left. Jimmy Carter made Henry Kissinger and detente and the lack of values of Kissinger's foreign policy the issue. So Ronald Reagan harbored a resentment and a distrust of Henry Kissinger that he never really overcame.
Walter Isaacson is the author of Kissinger, a biography. Isaacson will be back with us on the second half of today's show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we continue our conversation with Walter Isaacson about the life of Henry Kissinger. When Kissinger could no longer find a place for himself in American government, he started selling his expertise to large corporations with business interests overseas. Isaacson says Kissinger became the world's premier private power player. Also, writer Norman MacLean died in 1990, leaving behind an unfinished manuscript of the book Young Men and Fire. It's just been published, and critic Maureen Corrigan has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush campaigned today in Missouri, where he appealed to defense workers and announced a new sale of F-15 jet fighters to Saudi Arabia. Mr. Bush made his announcement after receiving assurances from Israel that it would not object to the sale. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports from St. Louis.
Mr. Bush aimed his campaign squarely at the jittery defense industry today, delivering tens of thousands of jobs with a single announcement. The president went to a McDonnell Douglas defense plant in St. Louis to announce the sale of 72 F-15 fighter planes to Saudi Arabia. Missouri Senator Kit Bond said Mr. Bush is trailing in state polls and needs to deliver. Mr. Bush has been criticized in recent weeks for handing out contracts, grants, and subsidies in politically strategic states. Congress has 30 days to reject the decision, but it would be a political risk because the sale would create jobs in Missouri, Connecticut, and California. Tonight, Mr. Bush will appeal to Christian traditionalists in Virginia Beach. Campaign aides are downplaying the evening speech to Pat Robertson's Christian Coalition, which holds positions many moderate Republicans consider to be extreme. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in St. Louis.
Democratic presidential contender Bill Clinton spoke at Notre Dame University today, where he talked about tolerance and said that every child born in the U.S. is owed the chance to make the most of his or her God-given potential. He said that he wants a nation that offers every child a healthy start in life, decent schools, and the chance to go to college or to job training worthy of the name. Once again, Clinton stressed his plan to offer college loans to all students and allow them to pay it back through public service. Everything appears ready for tomorrow's planned launch of the space shuttle Endeavour. Forecasters say the weather should not be a concern, although a cold front may move through the Cape Canaveral area. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
The Air Force says there's a 70% chance that conditions will favor an on-time liftoff. NASA's newest shuttle Endeavour will be making its second flight into space. The seven-member crew includes the first black female astronaut, the first married couple to fly in space together, and the first Japanese astronaut to fly aboard a U.S. spaceship. They will be joined by some unusual crewmates, which include oriental hornets, fruit flies, fertilized chicken eggs, and several frogs. The cargo is part of the experiments that will go on inside the European-built space lab. That chamber is located inside the shuttle's cargo bay, where the crew will work around the clock conducting experiments on behalf of NASA and the Japanese scientific community. Liftoff is set for no earlier than 10:23 a.m. Eastern Time from the Kennedy Space Center. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up less than 1 point to close at 3,305.70 on volume of 181 million shares. This is NPR News. In parts of Hawaii, residents in beachfront areas have left home and moved into Red Cross shelters as a hurricane termed very dangerous heads their way. Hurricane Iniki has wind gusts of up to 175 miles an hour and has been termed a Class 4, when Classification 5 is the strongest. U.S. Navy ships at Pearl Harbor have been sent out to sea to ride out the storm. Forecasters are concerned that this hurricane could be much more destructive than one that caused $216 million in damages 10 years ago. Jewish settlers in the Golan Heights have launched a campaign to protest the possibility of an Israeli withdrawal from the territory. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
Representatives of the more than 12,000 Israeli Jews living on the Golan held an emergency meeting today to formulate a plan to fight any Israeli withdrawal from the Golan Heights. They plan a demonstration tomorrow at the airport as the Israeli delegation to Arab-Israeli peace talks returns to Washington. The talks resume on Monday. Yesterday, Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin told Israel Radio that peace with Syria implies some sort of territorial compromise. This seems to mean that in exchange for peace, Israel would withdraw from part of the Golan Heights, which it captured in 1967 and later annexed. In response to Rabin's interview, Syrian Foreign Minister Farouk Ashara said Syria will not agree to territorial compromise and demands a complete Israeli withdrawal. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
A cloudburst sent a rush of water down a mountain gorge near Cherokee, North Carolina, forcing the evacuation of hundreds of people overnight. Some 800 people around Big Cove were ordered out last night, about 50 miles west of Asheville in western North Carolina. Most of those forced out were allowed back several hours later. During the storm, a trout farm overflowed, taking some 650,000 fish out of holding tanks. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. We've invited Walter Isaacson back for the second part of our show to tell us more about Henry Kissinger, the subject of his new biography. We heard earlier about Kissinger's shuttle diplomacy. Now we'll hear about Kissinger jet set celebrity. And we'll find out about what Kissinger's been up to since leaving government. Isaacson told us about Kissinger's secretive and conspiratorial approach to diplomacy. He's also been pretty secretive about the business he created after he left government. Kissinger's company, Kissinger Associates, has an office on Park Avenue, but it's not listed in the office tower's directory. There's no name on the door. Isaacson told me what Kissinger's company does.
He has about 30 clients, international firms and corporations, and he provides them he's a consultant for them. He provides them with strategic advice. He advises them about international affairs. He serves as sort of a personal secretary of state for the company and for the chairman of that company. He will travel around with the chairman or the presidents of those companies. He'll help open doors around the world. Take a few examples. Freeport-McMoRan, a large mineral and gas exploration company based in Louisiana. Not very well known around the world. But Kissinger is paid about $250,000 a year retainer to act as sort of the national security advisor and secretary of state for that firm. And he travels around with James Moffat, who's the chairman of the firm, and a few years ago they went to Indonesia together. Freeport-McMoRan wanted the copper concession in Indonesia, and it was what turned out to be a $5 billion deal over a 30-year period. Freeport-McMoRan got the concession, partly because when Kissinger arrived in Indonesia, the prime minister and all of the cabinet is out there to greet Henry Kissinger. He can get in to see them. He can bring the chairman of Freeport-McMoRan to see them. So he helped make that deal possible. Now, when I talk to James Moffat, the chairman of Freeport-McMoRan, and I talk about Kissinger's fee, he says that fee is a drop in the bucket compared to the commitment we are going to have to make in Indonesia over the next 30 years. And it makes me feel a lot more comfortable that I have Henry Kissinger on my side helping me deal when I go to Indonesia.
Now, it's still not that unusual to tune in a television panel discussion on a political issue and find Henry Kissinger on the panel. Do you think it's a conflict of interest when somebody's representing business interests abroad to also be, consulted by journalists as a foreign policy expert as opposed to as a business consultant? I mean, you wear so many different hats.
Yes, definitely. I think there's a conflict of interest there because he's very secretive. Totally secretive about his clients. In fact, in my book, I think it's the first list of his clients because the contract says both sides have to keep secret who the clients are. So when he goes on the air, for example, right after the Tiananmen Square massacre, ABC News sends up its a camera crew to interview Henry Kissinger live on the evening news. Kissinger has paid a $100,000 consulting fee to be on ABC. On the air, he says, I don't think we should have sanctions against the Chinese government. We have to realize it's in our national interest to keep close ties with China and that this is essentially a domestic problem within China. He does not say, nor does ABC News say, that he's been working with H.J. Hines, consulting about setting up a baby food factory in China, or that he's been working with American International Group, a group of insurers, America's major insurance company that has offices in Shanghai and wanted to build an office building there, and that he's formed even an investment firm within Kissinger Associates called China Ventures for companies that want to make investments in China. Now, he argues, and I'd like to give him his say here, that China Ventures never really got off the ground and that none of his opinions have ever been influenced by the fact that he had financial interests in a country. And I believe there's some truth to that. I believe he would have supported the Deng Xiaoping regime even if he didn't have a nickel's worth of financial interest in it. That's his position. That's his philosophy. But I think it would be better, and there would be less of a chance of a conflict, if he would at least somehow say, when he's writing his newspaper columns or going on the air, that he has businesses that he consults with who do business in China, and he's given them advice about how to do business in China, and then he can go on and say what he believes we should do about China.
My guest is Walter Isaacson. He's written a new biography of Henry Kissinger. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Walter Isaacson is my guest. We're talking about his new biography of Henry Kissinger. Here's the real mystery that I want you to clear up for me. How did Henry Kissinger get to be a media celebrity, and why has he so often been on panel discussions? Now, I realize he has always been an expert on international affairs and has, in fact, been making those policies, or, you know, did make those policies for many years. On the other hand, in spite of all his expertise, I have always found him to be an incredibly boring speaker on television. He speaks in a monotone, no facial expression. I mean, everything that you're supposed to be when you're on television, he's not. Yeah. And yet, you'd think that he had this kind of like animal magnetism on television, judging from the amount of time that he was used. So please clear up this mystery for me.
Well, two things. First of all, he is very brilliant in the best and worst sense of that term. Understanding foreign policy, and I think that does come across. People do respect his judgments. But also, this is very important, he has understood one of the magical truths of our media age. Everybody understands that power translates into celebrity sometimes. What he realized is that celebrity can also make you more powerful, that being a celebrity makes people listen to you and take you more seriously. So he cultivated his air of a celebrity. He'd do all sorts of things, including doing the weather on CBS Morning News when he was asked to do it, partly because he tends to his reputation of being a celebrity. And it's an amazing feat. You look at other former secretaries of state, Ed Muskie, Cyrus Vance, Dean Rusk. I mean, they can enter restaurants and nobody will turn an eye. But when Kissinger enters a room, when he goes on TV, he is able to wrap himself in a celebrity aura that exudes power.
How did he become part of the celebrity class in America? You know, hobnobbing with the rich and famous, and with, you know, famous actors.
And actresses,
right, yeah. And you know, dating celebrities and everything. It's a fairly unusual set of personal relations for someone of his political stature.
Yeah, it's absolutely astounding that a pudgy refugee professor with thick glasses and a thick waistline and an even thicker accent could become the world's most unlikely sex symbol. But when he, soon after he did his secret trip to China and Nixon revealed it, he became a media star, he started playing on that celebrity. And he'd go to parties and talk about himself as being a secret swinger, and he'd get in all the gossip columns, and he started dating Hollywood starlets. He wasn't married at the time, and it's not often that pudgy Harvard professors can date Jill St. John or Liv Ullmann or whatever celebrities they want. So he loved being seen with the starlets, and he realized that that enhanced his celebrity aura, and it enhanced his power in some ways. Once when he was out on the West Coast, he asked out a very intelligent, nice woman named Karen Lerner, said he wanted to go out with her one evening, and they made a date. And then when the evening came along, he said, I want to go see the opening of the show Gigi. And Karen Lerner said, well, that's not very good because my ex-husband, Alan J. Lerner, wrote that play, and it's the opening night, and I don't want to try to upstage him by arriving with Henry Kissinger at the performance. Let's just go have a nice romantic dinner. And he said no. He sort of hemmed and hawed and broke the date and called up Jill St. John and had his first date with Jill St. John and took her there. And all the cameras and all the gossip columns the next day were about how President Nixon's national security advisor arrived at the opening of a play with Jill St. John. Now, the dirty little secret about Kissinger's love life is that there aren't many dirty little secrets, as Jill St. John says when you talk to her. He loved to be seen. He loved to be in public. He loved to be with you when the cameras were on. But once the evening was winding down, he'd drop you off. He wanted to go out with starlets, but not really go home with them. And I think it was mainly done because it gave a great thrill to go out with the starlets, to be in the gossip columns, to have his picture taken, and to be dating Hollywood starlets. I did ask Jill St. John the question you asked me. Why would he want to be dating Hollywood starlets and going to glittering parties and with celebrities? And she paused for a long time, as if I had sort of asked, well, why would a fish want to be in water? And I guess it's sort of obvious why any, I'm sure, any of us wouldn't mind having our time dating starlets and going to glittering Broadway openings.
Do you think Kissinger was good at knowing how to use the press?
He played the press like a violin. He would call in a reporter and he would say, now you're the only reporter who will understand this, and I'm confiding in you, and I'm not going to tell anybody else in the press, but you will understand why I've done this China trip this way, and I will give you some of the secret dealings I had with Mao. And then the columnists would write fawning columns or profiles of Kissinger, and that gave him a great power within the Nixon administration. Nixon got so furious he wanted to fire Kissinger at one point, but it was hard to do because Joseph Alsop and Husaide and all the columnists were saying that Henry Kissinger is the best thing the Nixon administration has going for it. So when he would get into his office, come into his office, and maybe he would have a meeting with Haldeman or Ehrlichman. They would tell me this tale, and there'd be a pile of phone messages. And before the meeting would start, Kissinger would go through the messages, and he would throw out most of them, but he would put on top the ones that were from major Washington columnists like Joseph Alsop or Joseph Kraft, or from Ted Koppel and Bernard Kalb and the TV people who covered him. And then he would return those phone calls before the meeting even started. And Ehrlichman would do the accent and tell the tale of Henry Kissinger purring into the phone and talking to a Joseph Kraft or a Ted Koppel and explaining some bit of foreign policy derring do that had just occurred.
You've said that Kissinger really knew how to play the press like a violin. When you interviewed him for your biography, did you ever feel like he was playing you?
He was very, very charming. He was very intent on making me understand his side of the story, but I did not feel that he was overtly manipulating me. In fact, in some ways, I was kind of disappointed because I had put up a guard, I had put a shield up. I was all ready to be manipulated, to have my arm twisted, to have him tell me I was the most brilliant biographer possible, and that only I would understand why he had secretly bombed Cambodia. And he never really did that. He treated me very professionally, and I sort of you know, there was something in me that said, hey, why isn't he trying to stroke me and manipulate me? But I respected very much the way he treated me and the way he was professional in his dealings without trying to put pressure on me or spin me too much out of control.
I have one non-Kissinger question for you. How did someone like you, who is obviously so absorb in the workings of government and policy, end up editing the back of the book of Time magazine, the arts and entertainment part.
I was national editor of Time magazine for about 4 years, from 1984 to 1988, did politics, and that's when I started the Kissinger book. After that, I covered foreign policy and went to Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, covering the collapse of communism. And I guess when I got back from all of that, and when I was just finishing up my book, my editors at Time felt that I needed to be a little bit more well-rounded. I needed to see a few movies. I needed to go to a few concerts and worry about science and society and the arts a little bit more. And I welcome that. It gave me a chance to do things like interview Woody Allen as opposed to interviewing Henry Kissinger.
And what was it like to interview Woody Allen? He was a troubled man when you got to speak with him.
I think that... like Kissinger, in many ways, he didn't see the moral dilemmas that arose from the consequences of his actions.
Boy, I know. You know what happens when you write a biography? You see that person in every move that you make. I guess that's happened to you.
One of the interesting things that happened when I was doing my interviews for Kissinger was getting to spend some time with Richard Nixon, who's absolutely obsessed with Kissinger. He admires Kissinger, but also, as I said in the book, felt Kissinger needed psychiatric help and ordered that sort of thing. But when you talk to him now about Kissinger, he's both praiseworthy of Kissinger's mind, but very jealous that Kissinger's getting too much credit. And so he would say things like, well, I would never say that Henry Kissinger was a paranoid person who hogged all the credit, but, and then he would give me some anecdote. And even trying to interview Nixon, you see the reflections of history. I don't tape record my interviews usually, and I would take shorthand. But when I went to President Nixon for the formal interview, he said, do you mind if I tape this interview? And I said, no, I don't mind. And he said, as you know, I always like to tape things. And I looked up thinking he was kind of making a joke, since he got in real trouble by the Watergate White House tapes. But he had this little tape recorder, just me and him sitting in the office, and he tries to work the tape recorder. And after about a half hour, the tape runs out, and he can't get it to work again. It's one of those micro cassettes, and he's a man who's all thumbs when it comes to mechanical objects. So after about a minute or two of trying to get it the tape over and get it started again, he pushes it aside and says, well, I was never very good at these taping systems. I was never very good at that. And I started to smile, thinking he was making a joke, but I never was quite sure.
Yeah, he might not have realized what he was saying, I guess. Well, Walter Isaacson, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
I want to thank you for having me, Terry. It was a great show, and I really appreciated being on.
Walter Isaacson is the author of the new book, Kissinger, a Biography, and it's just been published. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what do you have on the campaign?
Terry, our far-flung correspondents will be reporting in. The president is giving away some more presidential largesse, this time contracts to build airplanes for the Saudi Arabians. Governor Clinton is talking about education. And we'll ask some questions about the schools. Are they as bad as President Bush said they were yesterday? Is what Governor Clinton is proposing going to help? It's also back to school in Florida, by the way, in the hurricane areas. We're going to ask if having Chief of Staff Jim Baker back at the White House is making it better for the president. And we have a fascinating story from Somalia filed by Daniel Swerdling.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Writer Norman MacLean, who died in 1990, is celebrated for his book A River Runs Through It, which is a modern classic about fly fishing, memory, and grief. Now the University of Chicago Press has published MacLean's manuscript of Young Men and Fire. It's a true story of the 1949 Man Gulch Fire. The fire claimed the lives of 12 young smoke jumpers, the Forest Service's elite corps of airborne firefighters. Maureen Corrigan says that MacLean's book is one of the most moving works of nonfiction she's ever read.
At some time or other, all of us who love Norman MacLean have made the same rueful comment. It's a shame, we say to ourselves, that MacLean waited until he retired to start writing. For most of his life, MacLean was an English professor at the University of Chicago. He was 70 years old when he began writing A River Runs Through It. After that book was published in 1973, McLean researched, relived, and wrote about the Mann Gulch fire. The manuscript was unfinished when he died at the age of 87. But this time, I'm not even tempted to say what a shame it is that McLean didn't start the book earlier. Because Young Men in Fire is a story about facing death. And I think McLean knew that he'd only have the wisdom and the right to tell such a story near the very end of his own life. The bare, horrific facts of the Mann Gulch fire are these. On the afternoon of August 5, 1949, a crew of 15 smoke jumpers parachuted down into the Montana wilderness to fight what they thought was a manageable fire. The youngest of the crew was underage at 17, and all of them were so green that, as McLean writes, they hadn't learned to count the odds or sense they might owe the universe a tragedy. The crew started working to contain the fire around 5 p.m. The next day, rescue workers found a wristwatch near the body of one of the men. Its hands were melted at 4 minutes to 6. According to the three survivors, what happened during those intervening minutes was that the crew was trapped by a blow-up, a lethal explosion of wind and flame. When the foreman, whose name was Wag Dodge, realized the danger, he ordered his crew to drop their tools and run up the steep side of the gulch to the safety of a rock ridge. Minutes later, Dodge looked back at the speeding wall of fire. Its flames were 30 feet high and 300 feet deep. He saw his crew wouldn't make it to the ridge, and then, in the midst of chaos, Dodge invented a way out. He set what from then on would be known as an escape fire, a small fire that would leave a burnt-out patch of land the larger fire would have to travel around. Dodge shouted to his terrified crew to throw themselves face down in the hot ashes with him. None did. Two men made it to the ridge. Two were burned almost beyond recognition and died the next day. The rest were dead within 30 seconds of running past Dodge. Later, some grieving parents would charge that Dodge's escape fire was actually the fire that killed their sons. As a young man, McLean saw the Mann Gulch fire for himself when it was still burning weeks later. As an old man, he climbed back to the site with two of the survivors. He uses science, math, and compassion to obsessively sift through every detail of the fire. He also confronts the larger questions that people always ask in the face of tragedy. Did anything good come of this? Was it inevitable? Why? Young Men in Fire is a spare meditation on human frailty and the mysterious workings of the universe. Like his subjects, McLean lost a race with time. But the manuscript he wrote is a heartbreaking tribute to all of them.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Ron Barron, Richard Parker, and Stephen Waterman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Tales of the South Bronx from Abraham Rodriguez. He's just written his first collection of short stories. He's always loved to read and to write, which are just two of the reasons he was considered a freak in his neighborhood. Lucky for him, he could talk circles around anyone, including the gang members who wanted to beat him up. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.